February 3rd, 2008, Wellington, New Zealand, Bhagavad Gita, chapters 7 through 12.
Ma Om Vishnu Puraya Krishna Prasthaya Vipi Vajra Mata Rakti Vedanta Swami Nityanami Namaskari Sarasvati Devi Gauravani Pacharani Nirasi Sasimadani Paskatiyadi Sitaya Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Ta Padakamalam Shri Guru Vishnu Vamscha Shri Rupam Sahagrajatam Sahagana Agamattam Vatam Stam Sikiram Sadvaitam Sadvaditam Parijana Saita Krishna Chaitanya Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sahagana Lalita Shri Shakam Vipanshtha Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya
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 So we're doing a series on the Bhagavad Gita. And yesterday we went through chapters 1 through 6. Today we're going to be going through chapters 7 through 12 in 45 minutes, having some time for questions. Well, Arjuna listened to the Bhagavad Gita that fast, so maybe we can do that also. Right? And the Bhagavad Gita, if we understand the Bhagavad Gita correctly, then we can live happily in this world and we can achieve the supreme destination of full freedom and love of God. And that is the message of Bhagavad Gita. So I thought we'd just very, 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 very quickly review chapters 1 through 6. So we're starting out on the battlefield, right? The good guys versus the bad guys. And there's the supreme good guy, God himself, the absolute truth, on Arjuna's chariot, wanting to have good leaders in the world, which is something that we all want. And there armies are poised, they blow their conch shells, and Arjuna says, bring me between the two armies. And when he sees his friends and family, he decides it's not worth it. And he gives four arguments. What were his four arguments?
Compassion.
Family, sin.
Family.
Destruction of family. And?
Enjoyment.
Right. He said, I really feel sorry for all these people. I don't want to hurt them, and I'm not going to be happy anyway. We've all felt like that sometimes in a difficult situation, right? I don't want to do this. It's not going to make me happy anyway. And he said, I don't want to be killed by them, nor do I want to kill them. I don't want to enjoy the earth. I don't want to go to heaven. I don't want anything. I don't want to do anything. Let me just give up everything and go beg, right? And then he did something intelligent and said, Krishna, I accept you as my guru, right? Actually, before he says my disciple, yeah. Before he said that, Krishna said, hey, come on, get up, buddy, you can fight. What is this? What's going on here? This doesn't become you. And then Arjuna says, you know, I'm completely confused. I'm your disciple. And then Krishna says, what's his argument for compassion? That really everybody is a soul. As a soul, this idea of killing, being killed, this is an illusion. No one's being killed. We're all eternal. And what's his argument for enjoyment? Yeah?
That you'll enjoy if you do your duty.
Yes. Yes. First, he gives a material argument. And he says, really, if you want to enjoy, you're kshatriya, you fight a righteous battle. And then you'll either conquer the earth or go to heaven. So really, if you want to enjoy, this is the way to enjoy. And anyway, real enjoyment is something different. Real enjoyment is transcendental. Real enjoyment is above the material sphere. Real enjoyment is by doing your duty as a sacrifice. What's his response for sin?
If you don't do your duty, you're
Yes, not doing your duty is sinful. And what's his response for destruction of family? That will break down the family. Just like nowadays, we see a breakdown of families. It's happening even in India, isn't it? You know, how many generations before India is not much different than Europe? Scary. And that comes from a lack of duty. Why do I have to do any duty? Just let me take care of myself. All right, so that's Krishna's instructions, and he said you do your work dedicating everything to me, and two people doing the same thing, but one in material consciousness and one in spiritual consciousness are just like day and night. Just like day and night. And then Krishna starts talking more about working as a sacrifice. So what chapter are we on now? Three. It says, working as a sacrifice brings happiness to individuals and it brings happiness to society, and even Krishna works in that. And generally, if people stop doing their duty, it's not because they're so renounced. Why do people usually give up their duties? It's due to lust. Lust only. So generally, people, they think, oh, I'm very renounced. And we've seen this even in the Hare Krishna movement. I'm very renounced, and actually, it's lust. You know, I'm going to stop doing my duty. My duty is so much trouble. And as we said yesterday, what happens is, you're doing something, and then you see what? What do you start to realize? That my what is wrong? My motives are wrong. That was what Arjuna was saying. My motives are wrong. And the response is then, well, I'll just stop the activity. And Krishna is saying, no, keep doing the activity and change your motives. Right? And why do we want to stop doing the activity? Because why do we want to change the activity instead of the motives? It's easier. Does it work? No. And Krishna says, you're going to do it anyway. Because that's useless. Right? He said, instead, work with knowledge. And then he starts giving that knowledge. And just like Krishna Loka introduced me, otherwise you think, who is this lady? Why should I listen to her? Right? So Krishna is also saying to Arjuna, why should you listen to me? Saying, I'm the Supreme Lord, he's saying. He said, this knowledge is eternal. I spoke it to the sun god. And, of course, Arjuna questions that. And Krishna starts giving a little bit of his own credentials, which he's going to do more today. And then he starts talking about, he told Arjuna to work as a sacrifice, right? In the third chapter, he was talking about sacrifice. Now, in the fourth chapter, he details all different ways of sacrifice. You can sacrifice the hearing process. You can sacrifice the breath. You can sacrifice the senses, right? And then you might say, well, what do I do? And then Krishna says, what? Yes, that he will say. But when he goes through the sacrifices, right after that, approach a spiritual master. You know, you go to a university, there's so many courses. How do you know which one to take? You have an advisor, right? You have an academic advisor. So Krishna is saying there's all these kinds of sacrifice. You should approach a spiritual master, right? And then he's putting this together. He's going to put together this transcendental knowledge and working as a sacrifice in the fifth chapter, where Krishna goes more into detail. He explained it in the third chapter, but now he's going more into detail about how to work as a sacrifice. To work as a sacrifice, you have to realize that you are
not the doer.
Not the doer. That everything's being done by nature. Right? You have to have that kind of consciousness, that I'm separate from everything. You have to see equally. You don't see in terms of friends and enemies, which he gets into more in the sixth chapter. And where does your pleasure come from?
Within you.
Within you. You get pleasure from within. And your peace is not from winning or losing or gaining the battle. Your peace is from seeing Krishna as the enjoyer, right? Krishna as the friend. And Krishna says, you do this. He ends the fifth chapter with saying, you do this by yoga, by putting your life energy at the Ajna Chakra. And then in the sixth chapter, Krishna goes into this yoga. And he says, yes, it's true that for neophytes, they should work, and for advanced persons, they can give up all material activities. And they do this by practicing yoga. And the main essential part of the yoga that Krishna explains in the sixth chapter is controlling the mind. And he's giving this very, very detailed practice. You go sit here, you sit on this, you do this. And what does Arjuna say at the end of this? Too difficult. And his question is, what happens if I fail? It's too hard. What happens if I try this and fail? And Krishna says, don't worry. Even if you do fail, still, you're a success. Even a little effort will bring you success. And at the end, he says, no matter better than anything you could do is to be a A yogi. And the best yogi is? A bhakti. Okay, so that's where we are right now. And the first six chapters of the Bhagavad Gita are focused on what would you say? What would you say is the main, if we could say one unifying
karma.
Theme? Karma, work?
Working in
activities,
devotion.
Working in devotion, activities, and? Who is being described in the first six chapters to a large extent? The living entity. Yes, the living entity. So we get some good description of who we are and how we should work. Right? Is there much information about Krishna in the first six chapters? No. A little bit. Very little bit. Mostly in the fourth chapter. But just a few verses. Is there much information about the way the world works? Little bit. We're moving from one body to another. A little bit. You know, that Krishna's talked about karma, vikarma, akarma. Something about the way the world works, but not so much. Mostly, who am I and how to work? So now, Krishna keeps saying that we should meditate on the Supreme and that the best yogi is one who's dedicated to Him. Well, then we have to know something about Him. Right? If I say, you know, you should work for this company, you need to know something about the company. So in 7 through 12, Krishna is speaking about Himself, and He's specifically speaking about bhakti yoga. 1 through 6 is speaking mostly about karma yoga, and 13 through 18 mostly about jnana yoga. These yogas are not really separate. They're different stages, one could say, in bhakti. So there's some description of Krishna in the fourth chapter, and there's also some description of Krishna in the 15th chapter. But the main place where Krishna describes Himself is here in the middle parts of the Bhagavad Gita. And generally in the West, we put the most important part of a presentation where?
In the middle.
No, not in the West.
In the
beginning?
At the end.
Put it at the end. And of course, Krishna has put some of the most important verses at the end. The reason for that is that people always remember the last thing you say. If you're going to be a presenter somewhere, always try to be the last. You know, if there's going to be a bunch of different people and you're the only devotee, try to be last. People usually remember the last thing. What often happens when you give a class is all people remember is the last question that was discussed, and they forget the whole class. It's quite a bit. But the way that the Shastra is organized is generally the most important part is in the middle. Right? It's a somewhat different culture. All right, so where does Krishna explain about Himself in this middle? A lot in the 7th chapter, 9th, 10th. So 7, 9, 10th. The places where you're going to find a lot of descriptions about Krishna, a little in the 4th, 7th, a little in the 9th, 10th, and the 15th. So that's what you're going to find in those sections, verses that really help us meditate on Krishna. Okay, so Krishna is explaining in the beginning of the 7th chapter that there is God, the living entities, and nature, which of course are the three main categories of the Bhagavad Gita, the living entity, God, and nature. And he's saying that He is the origin and the essence of everything. So as Krishna describes Himself in the 7th chapter, and we hopefully get to look at a few of those verses, but you'll find that each of those descriptions is either the origin or the essence of everything. So that's in the 7th chapter. And then you might say, well, if you're the origin and the essence of everything, why doesn't everybody know about you? And he says, really, if you're under the modes of nature, you can't know me. You're prevented from knowing me. And then Krishna talks about 4 and 4. What are the 4 and 4?
4 kinds.
And? 4 kinds who don't. He's saying there are 4 kinds of people who do come to know of me, even in this world, and there are 4 kinds who don't. What are the 4 kinds that do?
Devotee.
Devotee, that's the jnani is almost like a devotee. The jnani, that's like the 4 kumaras, Sukadeva Goswami, people who are already Brahman realized, and then they want to go on to Krishna. So that's and Krishna really glorifies the jnani there. He says they're just like myself. Okay, who else?
Distressed.
Inquisitive. And?
Seeking the truth.
Inquisitive is seeking the truth. Wanting wealth. Or wanting, in general, wanting material happiness. Wealth is a symbol for material happiness. So wanting happiness, wanting freedom from distress, which is similar but a little different. And we were talking yesterday about what do I want to get away from, right? And what do I want instead? So some people, I just want to get out of distress. And other people, I want happiness. And the four kinds of people who don't surrender to Krishna are?
Atheists.
The atheists, out and out atheists. Can I have some water? And who else?
Naritala.
The lowest among mankind, yes. And who else? Yes, philosophers who are very knowledgeable, but their knowledge is stolen by illusion. They're reading Bhagavad Gita and they're saying, you don't know, Krishna says surrender to me, but he means surrender to the unborn, vague stuff. He doesn't really mean what he says. So their knowledge is stolen by illusion. And the fools. The guy who just goes to work, does his work, comes home, drinks the beer, and watches the game on the television. And once or twice in his life goes, oh, I wonder what the world's all about anyway, and then forgets all about it.
Yeah.
You know, maybe asks a question at a funeral or something like that, and then kind of goes on with life. So those are the fools. All right, and then Krishna also says that besides the people who do and do not surrender to him, there's also people who surrender elsewhere. They surrender to demigods, or they want to become part of the impersonal Brahman. So there's several different categories. And Krishna says that he doesn't reveal himself to everyone because people in this world are born into the duality of desire and hatred. Desire and hatred. And that's what's moving us in this world. You know, we're desiring and hating things. I'm sorry, asking for water was a big thing. Please pay attention to the man in the corner getting the cup. Okay, thank you. Really, why are we desiring and hating things? What's the basis? On what basis do we either desire things or hate things? Yes, exactly. Exactly. Just like an animal, it smells something, and if that thing that it smells is food for that animal according to the modes of that body, it desires it. And if the thing it smells is not food for that animal, according to the modes of that body, it hates it. Okay? So for the animals, they're completely controlled by the modes of their body as to what they desire and hate. As human beings, we have the freedom to act, thank you, we have the freedom to act not as a human being at all, right? We have the freedom to act like an animal, or we have the freedom to act like a demigod. But generally, the conditioned souls desiring and hating according to what is pleasing to their senses, according to their particular modes. So therefore, different living entities under different modes are desiring and hating different things. One man's food is another man's poison. But as long as one is in this desire and hatred according to the body, one cannot know Krishna. And Krishna says, verse Prabhupada quotes a lot, that if we're free from sin, what is sin? Is it a list of bad things? That some mean God has put up because he doesn't want you to be happy? What is sin? Can anyone define sin?
To desire something that's separate from Krishna.
Okay, desire something that's separate from Krishna. Sin means if I try to eat the cup instead of drink the water. Why would I suffer if I tried to eat the cup?
It's not meant to be eaten.
It's not meant to be eaten. That metal is not in harmony with the body that I have. It's an untruth. If I say that metal is food, of course I can eat some metal. In fact, I need to eat some metals, don't I? We have some metallic requirements for our body. But if I try to eat metal in this form, it's not, my body is not suited for that. It's not the truth. It's not food. If I define that as food, that's a lie. And therefore, I become sick. So sin is anything which is untruth. That's how Krishna defines Maya. He says anything that appears to be of value, if it's without relation to me, has no reality. Know it to be my illusory energy, that reflection which appears to be in darkness. So if I do something that's not true, then I suffer. Or like going down a one-way road the wrong way. Or my son just called me from California yesterday, and he said that as he was pulling into his apartment complex, he saw this car that had been in front of him for a long, long, long time, going very slowly. And as it came to the apartment complex, all of a sudden the car sped up, went through a metal gate with concrete posts, and went off the edge of a cliff. And they found out the guy ended up being fine. Went down about 30 meters. The car was rolling down the cliff. Turned out what happened is it was a brand new car. I mean, he had just purchased it. He had just gotten it from the shop. Hare Krishna. He had just gotten this car from the shop. And he didn't know how to work it very well. And he went to put it into reverse to park. And he put it into drive. So, you know, he's trying to put it into reverse. And usually when you put a car into reverse, you have to give it quite a bit of petrol, right? Puts into reverse and guns the accelerator. And he went through a metal and concrete fence. Okay, so that's sin. Sin is when I'm supposed to put the car into reverse and I put it into first. I'm supposed to offer everything to Krishna. I'm supposed to work in accordance with Krishna's instruction, and instead I'm working according to the sense gratification of this body. Then instead of getting into a parking space and going out and showing my friends my new car, which was what he was trying to do, then instead of that, I go over a cliff and I think, oh, why am I suffering? And so when one gives up sin, when one is driving in the correct direction, then you can know Krishna. And you can know Krishna even at the time of death. So then Arjuna asks Krishna to define his terms. He says, you're talking about this and that and this and that. What does this mean? And then he says, and how does somebody know you at the time of death? How does that work? That seems kind of difficult. So Krishna briefly defines his terms. And then he explains that whatever we're thinking about during our life, especially at the time of death, because whatever you think about at the time of death is the most important thing in your life. An example I always give is how I was with my students, and they saw all this billowing smoke. They saw that there was this apartment complex on fire. And when we went there, there was this young woman standing outside barefoot with her three children. And she hadn't taken her money, she hadn't taken her shoes, she had taken her children. So when the house is on fire, you will try to save that which is most important to you. And the same thing when the body's on fire, when the body's dying, we will grab for that which is most important, for that which we value the most. And Krishna is very, very kind. And basically, he allows us to have whatever is most important to us. Now, of course, it's also according to our karma. So if what you think about is your house, but you don't have enough good credits to be born as a human in your house, you may be born as a dog in your house or a tree at your house or something like that. But that Krishna is saying where we go is determined by what we want. What we want. This whole world is based on desire. And there are many people who figure that out, and they try. We were talking about this yesterday. You know, New Age people who say it's all based on desire. That's true. It's also based on deserve and desire, not just desire. But ultimately, it's all based on desire, because if you desire something strongly enough, you'll do what you need to do to deserve it. Right? Makes sense? Desire doesn't just mean, oh, I wish I could have $1 million. It means that I want to have $1 million. Okay, I work hard. I do this. I do that. So Krishna is saying that, yes, whatever you what you get depends on what you really, really want. And what you really, really want is shown by what you think about when you die. And then in the next verse, wonderful verse, 8:7, Mama Nusmar Mujitcha. He said, therefore, always think of me and fight. Think of me and fight. How are you going to achieve me at the time of death? You think of me while you make me the most important person as you're doing so many things. And Krishna says, some people meditate on me. Again, first he talks about the Ajna Chakra, then he talks about the Sahasra Chakra, that one can bring the life energy there and meditate on Krishna that way. And he says, some people, they hope to get liberation mechanically by leaving their body at a certain time. It's like there's a time when the prison doors are open, you know, and if you know the right time, you can get out. Is that kind of liberation permanent? No. That's like letting somebody out of jail who hasn't reformed. What generally happens? They commit a crime again and they end up back. So these mechanical processes of liberation, like Kundalini Yoga and Satchakra Yoga, leaving the body at a particular time, they are mechanical means of opening the prison door. They're very, very difficult, extremely difficult. And you generally come back anyway. So you go through a whole lot of trouble to come back, which we'll talk about again at the 12th chapter. And Krishna says, you know, even though there's these mechanical processes, the perfection is to think of me all the time. That's really what we want to do. And then Krishna starts talking again about, okay, thinking about who am I? What is my nature? He's explained how he's the origin and the essence of everything. And now he gives these amazing verses at the beginning of the 9th chapter, where he says, Raja Vidya Raja Guyam, it's the most secret. I always wonder, well, if it's a secret, how's it a secret? It's right here, I can read the book and give it to people. It doesn't look very secret to me. But you'll see that as you read these books, it really is secret. It really is secret. The Shastra is sort of encoded. And it's really only available something like, if I look in a microscope, and if a scientist looks in the microscope, I'm seeing, but I don't know what I'm seeing. What am I seeing? Those little blobs running around. And the scientist can say, oh, this is happening, and this is happening, and this is happening. So how we understand the Bhagavad Gita, as Krishna's already just explained, depends on our degree of sinlessness. Right? Depends on our degree of purification. Just like the dog sees a rat as food because it's covered by the mode of ignorance. I don't see a rat as food. Right? Or the pig sees stool as food. Very few animals do that. Worms and like that. So what we perceive depends on what our filters are. This is what's known, psychologists know this all the time, that we are, none of us are seeing objective reality. None of us. What's happening is our mind is interpreting reality, and we're taking our interpretation of reality as reality. So the way to understand this knowledge, one has to interpret reality closer and closer and closer to the way Krishna interprets reality. If I'm interpreting reality the way a dog does, then I can read Bhagavad Gita and I don't understand it. Or I understand it in some different way. Therefore, it's secret. And as one's vision gets closer and closer and closer to truth, then one understands more and more in Bhagavad Gita. I think of it like layers. There's like layers of understanding, you know. You've had this experience, you read the verse in purport, you've read it 20 times before, and you go, wow, where did that sentence come from? Who put that sentence there? Somebody changed the books when I wasn't looking. Wow, amazing. Krishna says that. Whoa. You have this experience. And what's happened? What's happened is that you've come to a deeper level of purity. And therefore things that you didn't see before become revealed to you. And also the books are a person. The books are a person. And just like, you know, so some of you I don't know at all. Some of you I know slightly. I don't think I could say any of you that I know very well. And as you get to know a person better, what do? If you like them, you reveal more and more about yourself. So that's where Krishna is saying this is a secret. Secret. So then what Krishna goes on to say, these amazing verses, Maya Tatami Dam Taram, Jagadavyaktimurtina, Matsani Sabrabhutani, Nachaham Te Subhatita. By me in my unmanifested form, this entire universe is pervaded. All beings are in me, but I am not in them. And whenever I teach this verse to little kids, they go, wait a minute, how Krishna says I'm not in them? I thought he's in everybody's heart. Right? And then Krishna goes on and says, but really everything doesn't even rest in me. I am aloof. So this is the Achinta Beta Beta Tattva. Krishna's in everything. Everything's in Krishna, but Krishna's not in everything, and everything's not in Krishna. At one and the same time. My glasses are Krishna, but they're not Krishna. The floor is Krishna, but it's not Krishna. We're Krishna, but we're not Krishna. Amazing philosophy. And then Krishna is saying again how he not only is he the origin of everything, but he controls everything. But he's not responsible for our actions. Just like, you know, somebody's managing an amusement park, but they're not responsible for what rides you choose to go on. You know, what you choose to eat at the concession stand. And then Krishna says, anyone who knows him as the origin and serve him, they are mahatmas, and they're under the control of the divine nature. Who is? Who's the divine nature? Srimati Radharani. And if you're not under Radharani's control, then whose control are you under? Durga Devi's. Who's Radharani's expansion, of course. She's also our mother, but Prabhupada says she's a very unusual mother. She's riding on a tiger, piercing us with a trident. And then Krishna repeats a lot of what he said in the seventh chapter. You know, the eighth chapter was sort of a little detour, in a sense, in response to Arjuna's questions. And now Krishna is repeating what he said. Just like the fifth chapter is very much a repetition of the third chapter, the ninth is very much a repetition of the seventh, but in greater depth. And Krishna again says, you know, even though I'm the origin and great souls worship me, still there are some who worship the demigods. There are some who also worship the impersonal Brahman. He said, but, you know, it's much better to be a devotee, because even if you're an imperfect devotee, even if you're sinful, you're still wonderful if you're a devotee. And worship of me, Krishna says, is so simple. Just patram pushpam pulam toyam. Just give me a leaf. If I don't need extensive austerities, you don't need, like, Rikasura to cut off your flesh, or, you know, what was it? Shalva, I think, who was eating only ashes for a year to satisfy Lord Shiva. You don't need to do that. Just give me a little water, and I'm happy. And even if you're sinful, it'll all be worked out in the end. Don't worry about it. Even if you're the most abominable, it will all be worked out. And of course, Krishna had already talked about offering food and sacrifice. So now with Patram Pushpam, he's showing who to sacrifice to and what to sacrifice. And then, just in case you might think, well, he's pretty ordinary, he's interested in flowers and leaves. Then again, he asserts that, no, I'm the Supreme Lord of everything. And that then Arjuna's really happy at this point. And he says, you know, my illusion is dispelled. And he's so happy just hearing these little descriptions of Krishna in the seventh chapter. And in the ninth chapter, you know, he wants to hear more. Krishna said, already said things like, I'm the taste of water, you know, I'm the butter, I'm the fire, I'm the sacrifice. Okay, tell me more. And Arjuna speaks that wonderful verse, how not only do I know you're God, okay, you're saying you're God. I mean, anybody could say, you know, I'm God. You're telling me you're God. I accept you as God, but you know all the sages accept you. Devala, Sita, Narada, everyone accepts you as God. It's not just that you're bragging. And it's not just that I'm your friend, so I accept you. Now, please tell me more. How can I meditate on you? And here Arjuna is asking, how can I meditate on you in the world? And here Krishna, instead of saying how he's the origin, the essence of everything, he talks about how he's the best of everything. You know, of mountains, I am the Himalayas, or of movable things. I am the Himalayas of mountains. I am Merus of fishers. I am the shark. Of wielders of weapons, I am Ram, which is personal. Of all these different things, I am the best, I am the best, I am the best. Whenever we see something wonderful, whenever we see something glorious, we can understand a little bit of Krishna. It's like in America, I've traveled to Niagara Falls. And you see that, here's Krishna. Krishna's power. This falling water can power a whole city. Right? You see some great mountain. Oh, there's Krishna. Krishna is great. And the idea is not just that there's, it's not that Krishna is saying literally that he's these things, but one can appreciate him as these things. Now, in the 10th chapter, we also have what many acharyas consider to be the four essential verses of the Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna explains that he's the source of everything, that devotees are very happy and satisfied to talk about them, to talk about him and his glories, and how he reciprocates with those devotees. This loving reciprocation that's happening between the Lord and his devotees. The bhakta, bhakti, and Bhagavan. The devotee, the loving exchange, and the Supreme Lord himself. So then Arjuna, he's very, very happy to hear how Krishna is in the world. And now he doesn't want to just hear how Krishna's in the world. He wants to see Krishna as the world. I had heard that you're in the world. I want to see you as the world. So Krishna starts saying, yes, here I am. And then he says, but you can't see me. You have to have different eyes. You have to have divine eyes. You have to have deva eyes, literally. What kind of eyes did Arjuna have before that? How was Arjuna seeing Krishna before that? As a friend. His mood was that of friendship. But now he had to have the eyes of the demigods to see Krishna as the world. Normally Arjuna didn't want to see Krishna like that. It was disturbing. It's like, if your daddy's a policeman, you really don't want to see him running around, and you're just like 3 years old. You really don't want to see him chasing the bad guys with guns blazing. It's kind of scary. Right? So then Krishna shows him how everything is in him. All places are in one place. Our concepts of space and time are not absolute reality. How we perceive space and time is not the absolute reality, because Krishna showed Arjuna all of space in one place, and he showed him all of time at one time. So he was able to see past, present, and future in one moment, and all parts of the universe in one place. So we can give many, many examples about how that space and time, or how one perceives space and time, is really only how one perceives space and time. And it is not how space and time are in an absolute way. So that was one of the things that Krishna was demonstrating, how everything's within his body. And although Krishna says that he's never shown that universal form to anyone, Krishna has certainly shown other universal forms to other persons. Who else has seen universal forms? Mother Yasoda. Mother Yasoda, yeah. Twice. And who else? Well, Sanjay was seeing it, but that at the same time. But who has seen another universal form at another time? Advaitacharya. Oh, very nice. Duryodhana. Yeah, Duryodhana saw the universal form, and he didn't surrender. He didn't surrender. Sometimes we think, if only Krishna would show himself to me, then I would surrender. Lots of demons see Krishna, they don't surrender at all. When Kalyavana saw Krishna, he thought, wow, he's so beautiful and delicate. Let me kill him. Kali, a serpent, also. Putana was also. Not many demons. They saw and they appreciated. Okay, also, Vamandev showed Bali, right? Universal form. Covered the whole universe. And then the universal form kind of shifts. Instead of just all places and all times, Krishna starts showing Arjuna his form as time, death. That's time. And he's specifically showing something that Arjuna wants to see. Right? He's showing Arjuna how all the soldiers are going to be killed. And it was a pretty gruesome scene. All these soldiers being chomped up in Krishna's mouth. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada says Krishna can and does eat everything. Okay? He's eating even Brahmins and cows. He's eating the whole universe. He's eating everything. But yet, when he asks for food, he says, if you're going to give me, an offering in love, you give me a leaf or flower, fruit or water. But certainly Krishna is capable of eating everything. He's eating the whole universe. So Arjuna goes through wonderful prayers. Prabhupada sometimes says that we can recite these prayers from the 11th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. And then at the end he says, okay, it's enough already. I'm really having a hard time maintaining my composure. Please show me your four-handed form and show me your original form. So Krishna says, happily do I show you these forms. And he shows him his forearm form and then his two-arm form. And very interesting there, he says, you can't know this form by austerity, by sacrifice, by worship. And then when Krishna says you can only know it by bhakti, in that purport, Prabhupada talks how you can do sacrifice, austerity, worship, and bhakti. So quite interesting. I suggest you look at those verses and purports at the end of the 11th chapter. Because it seems to be, you can't know me by these things. No, you can know me by these things in bhakti. So, Krishna's already talked twice about impersonalism, once in the 7th chapter, once in the 9th chapter. But now Arjuna's starting to become curious You know, you've talked about these impersonalists, and what's really better, worshiping your personal or impersonal form? And Krishna says, you know, really don't go the impersonal path. It'll be hard to achieve, and it'll be tough when you do achieve it. It's hard to achieve because you have to stop all actions, you have to stop all desires, and then when you get there, you won't be able to desire me and love me. And the example I always give of this is my sister's son, who in their own religion was living as a brahmachari, living in a brahmachari ashram, going to school, and he had his guru. And at a certain point, he went to his guru, and he said, I want to get married. And his teacher said, well, up till now, you haven't looked at any young girls. They're very, very strict. He said, so now I will introduce you to some young girl, but you have to look at her. So the impersonalists, they don't look at anything. Everything's Maya, everything's Maya. And then when Krishna comes, they don't look at him either. So very hard to do. And then once you've done it, it messes you up. So then Krishna says, the best thing is to always think of me. And if you can't always think of me, you should? That's follow the regular, follow sadhana bhakti. What will sadhana bhakti give you? Do you remember? Very nice. It says if you follow sadhana bhakti. No. Yes. He says you will develop a desire to attain me. Oh, thank you, Krishna. Mam ichaptam. Icha. Icha means desire. So Krishna is saying in the verse before, these verses are really, really, really important. Because these verses in the 12th chapter define what is the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And who is it? Where's Avani? You were saying you want to become a disciple of Vrindasarupa Prabhu. He often talks about these verses, especially 12, 8, 9, and 10. That basically the International Society for Krishna Consciousness is made up of people who are in 8, 9, and 10. 12, 8, 9, and 10. So 12, 8 is saying, fix your mind upon me. Does Krishna talk a lot in the Bhagavad Gita about thinking about him and controlling the mind? So just think of me. Engage all your intelligence in me. Devotional service is performed with the mind and intelligence, not just the arms and legs. Prabhupada says, you know, if you're in the temple but your mind is on another subject matter, it's not very helpful. So just fix your mind upon me. If you can't do that, abhyasa yogena. Abhyasa means practice. Abhyasa yoga, practice yoga. Abhyasa yoga is not real yoga, it's practice yoga. Just like anything else. You're practicing to play the piano. Da, 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 da. Are you really playing the piano? No. Are you playing the piano? Yeah. But are you really playing the piano? No. So abhyasa yoga, practice yoga, it's not real yoga yet. But it is real yoga. But it's not really. Do you follow? You know, you're in the kitchen practicing to roll chapatis. The cook's going to throw out all of them. Not going to cook any of them. You know? But you have to go through the practice stage. We all want to skip the practice stage. Everybody wants to skip the practice stage. Everywhere I go, I hear questions that the essence of the question is, how can I skip the practice stage? How can it just come naturally? Right? When am I going to have to stop working so hard? Practice means that it's that you got to remember, oh, I'm supposed to hit this key now. And this, yeah. What does it say on my music chart? Oh, yeah, okay. This key. Ooh, I hit the wrong key. Okay. Can go back. That's what practice means. And after you're not practicing, you just right? Think about something you're expert in. I hope you're all expert in something. Good. Think about something you're expert in. Do you have to think about it? Even like driving a car, do you have to think about it? Now I could put like this poor guy with his new car, you know, he should have been thinking about it. But if we've been driving a car, we know it just goes this way and that way and that way. But when you're learning, you got to be paying attention. So abhyasa yoga, and what will abhyasa yoga give you? Icha, icha. what practice yoga, what Abhyasa yoga, what sadhana bhakti will give you is the desire. Is the desire. And as soon as you have a strong desire, you're no longer in Abhyasa yoga. When you have the strong desire, naturally you're thinking of Krishna. Obviously, we have some desire even to perform Abhyasa yoga. You have to have some desire. But when that desire becomes very, very strong, just like, this is a sad story, but it's very relevant. And it's especially relevant to the beginning of this whole section, which was 7.1, where Krishna talks about a shakti. Actually, Bhagavad Gita 7.1 was the verse that Prabhupada quoted more of all the verses that he quoted. Krishna there also says, think of me, and he says, become attached to me. So what is this attachment? This attachment is the difference between Abhyasa Yoga, between text 8 and text 9. So just like one devotee recently told me this very sad story. She said that her husband became attached to another woman. This example is what's given in the Shastra, actually, as a comparison with how we should be attached to Krishna. Said her husband became attached to this other woman, devotees. And that people started saying to him, you know, the way you're acting with this woman is not very good. You should stop. And instead of taking their advice, what do you think he did?
He did it more,
and how?
Without other people knowing?
Yes, he went secret. So before he was just talking to her openly, oh, I'm helping her, I'm preaching to her, and so forth. And that was going on for months and months and months and months and months, and it was a little, people were saying, Prabhu, you know, your preaching to her has gotten a little funny now. And many people were saying it. So then they just started going secret. And finally, when it did become revealed, you know, his wife found some things in the room and said, was that woman here in the room? When everything came out, and so many devotees, so many gurus and sannyasis went to this man and said, you have to give this up. Do you think he listened? Did he listen? No, he didn't listen. And even when he said, yes, yes, I'm giving it up, they'd find secretly he's text messaging her. That's attachment. That's attachment, right? You're in the world and you start getting interested in Krishna. And you get more and more and more interested. And all your friends and relatives say, give up Krishna. And then you just start sneaking. And you start chanting in secret, right? And your mother and father and your religious leaders and everyone comes to you and says, don't worship Krishna anymore. And you don't stop, right? That you just determined. And this man told his wife, and he's a very respected devotee in the movement. He said, I don't care if I lose my reputation. I don't care if I lose my friends. I don't care if I'm thrown out of the Hare Krishna movement. I want this girl. That's how much we should want Krishna. I don't care what happens to me. Now, when you do that for Maya, it's pretty dumb. It's like, you know, you're really going to regret that in a couple years after the infatuation wears off, you know, and then you're going to think, what did I give up everything for? But that's how one, that's what Krishna means by icha. That by doing Abhyasa Yoga, the whole purpose of our sadhana bhakti is to develop this icha. Just like that. And if we're not developing it, then we need to apply ourselves a little bit better to our sadhana bhakti. And then people say, well, I can't do sadhana bhakti. It's too high. It's too high. I have to give up illicit sex. I can't do that. That's the biggest one, isn't it? That's the biggest reason why people say, I can't do it. You know, for some people, it's gambling. Some people take years to give up meat eating. Whatever. For some people, it's intoxication. For some people, it's the rugby game on the television. You know, whatever it is. For some people, it's getting up early in the morning. For some people, it's chanting 16 rounds. Whatever it may be. You know, I can't do this Abhyasa Yoga. Krishna says, all right, just do some work for me. Just do some work for me. So those are our three categories of people who are in the Hare Krishna movement. People who are already in love with Krishna, who are already fully absorbed in Krishna. People who are doing practice yoga in order to develop the desire to attain to Krishna. And people who are doing some work for Krishna. And then Krishna says, you can't even do that. If you can't even do work for me, then given charity at least. Get some sense that you're not the proprietor. Because you've given charity, after a while you'll think, I wonder who's the best person to give to in charity. And or you can cultivate knowledge. And the best thing is to cultivate knowledge. And then Krishna ends this section, this chapter, with a wonderful, wonderful description, which is very humbling, at least when I read it, of the qualities of a devotee. You know, starts with text 13 to the end of the chapter. Someone who's not envious, someone who sees with equal vision, someone who doesn't put anyone else into difficulty, someone who's not moved by the happiness and distress in this world, who doesn't rejoice or grieve over anything in this world, who's equal to friends and enemies, equal poised in honor and dishonor. And all these people are dear to me, Krishna says, and then he says, who's the most dear to me is someone who's in love with me. So I just did a quick summary, and already it's a few minutes after 8, and I still didn't have any time for questions, and what should I do? Okay, so just have me be a good servant and tell me what to do. Does this work a little better than yesterday? Is this a little better than the way I did it yesterday? Okay. And then I recapped yesterday, too, to give you better an overview of yesterday. So was that okay?
We got some 10 minutes.
10 minutes. So we have 10 minutes. Questions? Comments? Yes.
In chapter 7 is the solution is verse 7, it's 24. And if you could just experience this, how the impersonalists deal with that verse. And Krishna is very clearly saying that he's not a, because he thinks that I was impersonal before.
I don't know how the impersonalists deal. You'll have to ask the impersonalists how they deal with that verse.
Sometimes, you know, when preaching, you bring that verse up, and then
what kind of things do you hear? What kind of things do they say?
I don't know for this one, because they don't say anything. But for the 14th verse in the Brahmana Vipatishtaham, they say that no, that's actually he's referring to the Brahman, which is the material nature.
Okay, Brahmana Vipatishtaham Avitat. On the basis of the Brahman, that's fine. He's the basis of material nature too. No problem.
And so that we say then actually Brahman is meaning the Brahman effulgence?
Brahman can also refer to the material world. Sarva kalam idam Brahma. Everything is ultimately Brahman. We don't disagree with that. But no, they have a problem with some of these verses, don't they? Just like, what do we all do? We all tend to ignore the things that are violating our view of reality. Scientists do that too. They sadaputam judhakarma call it the knowledge filter. You have your view of reality, and if something is in opposition to that, you ignore it. Is that all right? Yes?
Just not sure. I've got a few questions, but it's kind of all around the same topic.
Okay.
First of all, can you explain how the scientists' knowledge, you know, the four people who are dukkha because their knowledge has been stolen by illusion, can you explain how, like, isn't it said that scientists will eventually get to understanding Krishna? Isn't that
maybe. It's not an absolute.
It depends what kind of science they are, right?
It completely depends on you. You can stay here forever. You can't stay in an animal body forever. Periodically, you will take birth as a human being. But you could take birth as a human being a couple times and then go back down in the animal species. And then go all the way back up, take birth as a human being. You'll take at least two births. You take one birth as an uncivilized person, one birth as a civilized person. And then you go back down again. You could do that. You know? Or you could take repeated births as a demigod. You don't have to become Krishna conscious.
Does it depend on you, or does it depend on the mercy that you receive?
That's the question, isn't it? Just reading in Chaitanya Charitamrita, in the conversation, Richard Tenenbaum was talking to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya and says the way to receive the mercy of the Lord is basically you have to come to the point of realizing you're not this body. if you really want to receive the mercy of the Lord. There's a... You can say, well, how do you get that without mercy? There's a dance between mercy and endeavor. Even materially. We've just heard that Krishna says that we're not doing anything. We are desiring only. We are desiring. As Sataputta gives the analogy, which I think is very helpful, that it's just like if you're playing a computer game and you have a desire to do something. So the person who's written the programming and the person who's run the server, they give you a means to try to attain what you want through the game. You know, you may have to earn... I've never played games, but I have watched people play games and talked to people who play games. You know, you have to earn so many things to go where you want to go. But you have to do something. You have to desire, and then you have to go through whatever process the game has you go through. But if the server's down, you can't do anything. You know. And the programmer, they're writing programs to facilitate people's different desires. So Krishna's arranged all these 8,400,000 different species of life, plus the individuality. Each of us have a somewhat individual body to fulfill our particular desires. And he's giving us the abilities. He's giving us the abilities even to get dressed, to eat, to talk, to think. So even materially, there's a relationship between our desires and our actions and Krishna's mercy. Without Krishna's mercy, we can't do anything. But Krishna's mercy is responding to our desires and activities. So that's true also spiritually. Krishna says, Yetamam prapadyante, as they surrender unto me, I reward them accordingly. And we say causeless because from a spiritual point of view, there's nothing you can really do to deserve spiritual mercy. You can do things to deserve material good karma. But you can't really deserve spiritual mercy, no matter what you do. But you can do things that induce Krishna to want to respond to you. You want to try to get him interested in you. Prabhupada said, don't act in such a way to try to see Krishna, act in such a way that Krishna will want to see you.
So what is the definition then of this people whose knowledge has been stolen by illusion? Like, you know how Prabhupada says in the purpose, but it's like the scientists or philosophers.
Mm.
What's the definition then? Like, in preaching? Because should we think, oh, that's it, it's the scientists, philosopher, there's no way they're going to understand. Or should we kind of understand what kind of scientist, what kind of philosopher they are? Try and get to know the real person.
That sounds like a good idea, the latter. You know, superficial categorization of people in 2 seconds is not generally helpful unless it's extremely obvious. You know, if somebody's running after the Harinam party with a gun, I don't think you should sit down and try to understand them in detail. And many people who appear to be atheistic at first may be more innocent. Mm-hmm. And we've seen that. I mean, we've seen people who appear to be atheistic or inimical that, given some time, they were just innocent. Mm. It wasn't a deep heart thing. Or it may have been somebody who was, they were hurt or they were cheated or something like that. And they just don't want to be cheated again. Mm. I visited the temple in Chicago several months before I actually moved in to stay. I stayed for a couple weeks. And I was asking a lot of really, how shall we say, piercing questions. I was asking a lot of heavy-duty philosophical questions. And then when I came back to stay, I remember one of the ladies coming up to me and said, I never thought you'd come back. She said, you were so challenging. And many times the people who say, yeah, Krishna consciousness is nice, yeah, it's all right, sure, you guys are nice. They just stay like that, you know, for 40 years. Just tell me when I have to end. Now or is it just give me a signal. You just tell me. Just give me a tell me when I have to stop. It's actually kind of hard for me to see the clock from here. I have to keep looking at my watch.
Sorry,
yes, a question.
Yes.
You know, in the first chapter, when Vishnu blows his conch shell,
yes,
he blows it to sort of give Duryodhana joy.
Yes,
but indirectly, Prabhupada was saying, indirectly by the symbolism of the conch shell, he informed his depressed grandson Duryodhana that he had no chance of victory in the battlefield because the Supreme Lord Krishna was on the other side. So, how is that symbolism of the conch shell?
Because the conch, although it's used by other people, it's one of the main weapons of the Lord. The conch symbolizes Vishnu or Krishna. So as soon as he could have used other things, he could have used a bugle or so many things. But by choosing to use a conch, he symbolized the Lord. Obviously other people use it. Just like in Vrindavan, many of the devotees decorate themselves with peacock feathers, not only Krishna. It's explained to all the cowherd boys as they're going through the forest, they're decorating themselves with peacock feathers. But we particularly associate a peacock feather decoration with Krishna. Although, even ordinary people in the world decorate themselves with peacock feathers.
And also, throughout the first and second chapter, when Arjun put forward his arguments, Prabhupada in the fourth book said it's because of his compassion. But then sometimes Prabhupada also explains that it's because, you know, like he was materially
affected.
So how can you be a sort of like a devotee and have compassion at the same time you're acting as materially?
The compassion wasn't wrong. It was the way he was interpreting and applying the compassion that was wrong. He was interpreting it and applying it materially. Material compassion or soft-heartedness is illogical. By definition, it means I'm not looking at the facts. I feel sorry for the poor criminal who's in jail, and you know, hard-heartedness is you just look at the facts and the logic and say this is the way it's supposed to be. But the devotee, there's a higher level of compassion. You know, Krishna, the devotees could just say, hey, you know, you guys wanted to come to the material world, you're in your karma, tough on you. He could be fair. Right? Krishna, I want out of here. Sorry, you know, you've got 5,000 lifetimes more karma you got to deal with. And during that time, you're going to be accruing new karma. No way out for you. Bye-bye, buddy. You're the one who wanted to come here. And isn't that the view of so many religious systems? That God is like that. That he's just this fairness guy. You know, and often their view is really extreme. It's not even fair. It's actually unfair in the negative direction. You're created at the time of conception. You're created an evil being. That's their philosophy, right? You're created an evil being at the time of conception. You're like a car that naturally swerves off to the side. You know, you were created defective. And you have one lifetime, which is not very long. And those of you who are young may not understand this, but those of us who are getting older, this life is not very long. You've got one lifetime, which is really, really short, to surrender to God, and you don't do that, you're finished. Finished. That's it. For eternity. And it's not like you just go into the state of non-existence. You're actually suffering for eternity. Whoa. So a lot of religious systems, they're not even teaching that God is a reasonable person. But he certainly isn't very merciful. Of course, then he has this other kind of strange mercy where you just go, I believe, and then everything's fine.
Yeah.
You know, that's also kind of odd. You know, there's this sort of opposite things. That if you don't say, I believe, you're doomed when you don't even have a chance. And if you say, I believe, then all of a sudden everything's okay. Right? So, no, it's not like that. There's mercy. And the mercy, it's a very reasonable kind of mercy. That, okay, you don't deserve to get out of here, but I'm going to help you anyway. And no, it's not going to be some magic thing that you just say, I believe, and everything's, you know. You have to actually develop the ichcha. You have to develop the desire. But I will help you develop that desire. So that kind of compassion is the compassion of the devotee. And Arjuna naturally had that kind of compassion. That's pretty heavy compassion, actually. And we see in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness, you know, especially those of you who have some leadership position or some counseling position, it's really, really hard to work with materially conditioned souls and help them develop a desire to attain Krishna. It takes a lot of compassion. It takes a tremendous amount of compassion. I think a lot of times people don't understand, like, what kind of service the spiritual master is doing. You know, if you talk to people who are taking that that role of guiding people and taking responsibility for them and what kind of stuff they have to put up with and how difficult it is and how carefully they have to guide people, you know, and they may see, you're really in Maya, you're really attached to this, but if they say, you know, that you're really attached to this, you may get angry and leave. Happens all the time. Or you may say, oh, you're not a real guru, you weren't kind to me. It happens. So it takes so much compassion. So much compassion to deal with people and their attachments. And, well, I want to do this, Guru Dave. It's not really very good for you. Well, I want to do this. Well, okay. So Arjuna had that kind of compassion, but it was being expressed materially. It was being expressed in a sentimental way. It was being expressed on the material platform. So it wasn't that it was a bad quality, but the way that it was being expressed and understood was harmful. Anything else? Yes?
Yeah. We know that the super soul enters every atom, and so the body is composed of so many atoms.
Mm.
So it's the super soul in every atom.
Yes.
And so that would mean that I was just reading Human Devolution, and there Prabhu makes the point that the Atma is also there with the Paramatma, but there is one Atma of the whole organism which actually gives us this individual consciousness. So could you explain a little bit more on that? Just elaborate. This is really interesting. This thing, you know, the Sarvam Kala Idam Brahma just really makes sense.
Yes, so you're starting to get into things that are very difficult for us to understand with the human brain and the Kali Yuga. There's a limit. And Ridhananda Maharaj really objects when anybody pulls out the inconceivable card, because he said, okay, you can just explain anything with that card. Like you're playing a game, it's kind of the magic card. Oh, inconceivable. So we can talk about it, but to some extent, us really trying to like a mental picture or trying to think of it logically is going to be a little difficult. And as far as the different cells, so just like in a business, so you have the head of the business and then you have so many workers in the business. You know, but especially if it's a business that's completely owned by one person and it's all their wealth and it's all their energy, if they pull out, then there may be nothing more to do and the business fails and all the workers have to go home. So there's many living entities in our body, but we're the chief in this body. And if we leave, then no one's sustaining them anymore. It's through, you know, our eating and our breathing that they're all sustained. So they stop getting their paycheck, basically. How long are they going to come to work without their paycheck? You know, they may work a little bit. You can artificially keep a heart beating a little bit and things like that for a while. But after a while, they're not getting any nourishment. So they also leave. Is that all right? Okay. Yes?
Is that connected a little bit with the question that often comes up when you're on the street? People say, okay, so if there's a soul living in every living being, and one soul living in each living being, then what's the story with a worm that gets cut in half? They say, because when a worm gets cut in half, then they carry both sides, keep on living.
Mm. So there's all different ways of reproduction, and reproduction means that some other living entity comes into a body. And there's all different interesting ways that goes on. So there are some living entities that reproduce by dividing. Does that mean the other soul was already there? Not necessarily. And Prabhupada describes with human reproduction that the soul enters the man's body through the grains that he eats. That some living entity who's destined to take a human body enters into the grains and enters into the man's body. So it's not that all men are walking around with potential human souls in them. The soul enters their body. So the same way, you know, different living entities reproduce in different ways, and the soul enters that body. I mean, very simple. You build an apartment, and somebody moves in. And if nobody moves in, then it starts to fall apart.
So the reproduction you're speaking about for this room is one that you can't really see.
Well, when do we ever see the soul entering the body?
Or,
you know, we never see that. We never see the soul that is meant to be the child or children entering the body. We don't see that. It's happening subtly. If you could see subtle things, you could. I'm sure there are people who can see subtle things because the soul's inside of a mental body. It's not just a soul. I mean, there are people who are more attuned to subtle things. They could probably see it.
It kind of just doesn't really quite make sense, because if you think about it, like there's like human beings that actually take, they actually enjoy cutting up wounds, and like that means that in one sense they're kind of controlling, being a controller, they're kind of giving, having that position. If it means that they can give birth again and again and again, it's kind of like,
well, the demigods are doing that too. The demigods have some control over who gets what body, and they're doing that kind of thing. And we've been demigods too. So the demigods are working with the soul. Okay, you get this mother and father, and they're manipulating the genes of the mother and father to give the new child the right combination that'll be suitable for their karma. And they're, you know, they're arranging that when it's time to give birth that a particular man and woman are attracted to one another. So they're engineering all that kind of thing, even for human beings, what to speak of for animals. Okay, it's time for these living entities to become puppies, okay. You know, what kind of puppy karma are they going to have? Are they going to be born to millionaires who are going to give them all little sweaters? And or are they going to be a street dog in Calcutta, you know? What's their particular karma? What dog father do they get? What dog mother do they get? And they're engineering all this. Okay, time for these living entities to become dogs here. Okay, see that female dog in heat, go for her. You know, they're arranging all these things. And this is even arranged in human society. So it's not so surprising that some human beings will be also be able, you know, human beings also have some sphere of control. But just like the demigods can't do things outside of Krishna's control. And if things start to go that way, then, you know, Krishna comes and readjusts things. The demigods give somebody some benediction or something that's a problem, then Krishna comes in and, you know, just touch your own head, buddy, it'll be okay. Mm-hmm. And he adjusts everything and puts everything back in order. Because, mm-hmm. Yeah, we have some independence in our sphere of control, and the demigods have even a little bit more independence. Mm-hmm. And Krishna manages the whole thing. But how does the soul, we don't see that. We don't see how that happens. The plants are producing seeds. Some of the seeds are duds. There's no soul in there. Just like some, you build an apartment house, some of the apartments don't get filled. You know, but where do we see all those souls entering into the seeds? We don't see that. It's not like if you just stare at it, you're going to see that happening. That okay? Yes?
I can say that I think I've got the answer myself, but just sometimes I've found myself, you mentioned about how Krishna puts things in control, and I've sort of seen at times where some order has been established, like from really attentively hearing the chanting, so you feel practically that there's order in my life, you feel I'm really connecting to Krishna. And then due to pride or whatever, you feel you're actually trying to fight against Maya or control things, and you really do feel this disordinate sort of way, we call it. And then you can feel it like you're on a flow, you're really going with this disorder. And then Krishna does put something in place to create order within some stuff or some reaction. I'm just wondering. You know, and you might even be hearing and chanting, but maybe not the same quality. So I was wondering how to get off that, you know, you can feel yourself on that flow, on that track to disaster, but you can get a sense that this is not glory. So
how to get off that before a disaster happens.
So this is the fall down sequence mentioned at the end of the second chapter. And what is the sequence? First is?
Lost.
No, before lost.
Contemplation.
Contemplation. The story I told you about this one devotee who got attached to another woman. How did that start? Contemplation. This works spiritually too. You start contemplating Krishna. So first is contemplation. Next is attachment. Next is lust. Lust means that you want something so badly that you don't care what the results are. It's not only referring to sexual lust. In general, anytime you want something, like this man was saying, I want this woman, I don't care if I lose everything in my life. You know, somebody who wants money like that. You know, I want to be rich, and I don't care if I have to break the law, do something sneaky. I don't care, you know, if I never see my family because I'm working 100 hours a week. You know, I don't care if I use cutthroat business methods and I put, you know, my best friends out of business and in competition with me. I want to be rich no matter what. So that's lust. And then from lust comes
anger.
Why anger? Why does anger come from lust?
Frustration.
Because we're frustrated. We're frustrated that either we want something really badly and we don't get it, or we get it, you know, you leave your wife, you sacrifice your reputation in the Hare Krishna movement, you get with this other woman and you find out that she blows her nose too. You know? Or you get it and then you're always afraid of losing it. You know, you get your money and then you're worried that all the people that you cheated to become rich are going to cheat you and get back at you. Or your children will cheat you to get your money, or who knows, you become afraid. Sankaracharya says this, you become afraid of your own children. You're living in a state of, so we become angry. And then from anger,
illusion.
From illusion? Bewilderment of memory and falling down in the material pool. So where do you want to stop this? You want to stop it at contemplation. Now, when a devotee attains to higher stages of Krishna consciousness, they stop it at the contemplation stage. They never allow themselves to contemplate Maya. And the reason they don't allow themselves to contemplate Maya is they can recognize Maya. I talked about this a little bit, I think, yesterday. They can recognize Maya from a distance. The problem is that until we have a certain level of purification, I was talking earlier about the filter. The problem is that until we're at a certain level of purification, when I see Maya, I do not recognize it as Maya. I don't recognize it as Maya. I recognize it as something desirable. I recognize it as something good. I recognize it as something that's going to help me. I don't see it for what it is. That's what Maya means, that which is not. I see something differently than what it actually is. And therefore, I think about it. And therefore, I become attached to it. And I don't usually notice that it's Maya. At what point do I usually figure out that it's Maya? Well, that depends how covered you are. If you're really, really covered, you don't figure out it's Maya till you fall into the material pool. If you're a little less covered, you figure out it's Maya when you've lost your intelligence. If you're a little bit less covered, you figure out it's Maya when you get angry. That happened to me several months ago. I had this problem, and I'd been trying to solve it for years, some difficulty with some other devotees. And I talked to a friend of mine in London, and I said, what should I do? You know, it keeps happening. And she said, you should go to each of them and ask for forgiveness. Well, of course, I thought that they should come to me and ask me for forgiveness. My instant response to her saying that was anger. I mean, I felt really, really angry. And as soon as I felt really angry, I thought, ah, she must be right. That was the sign for me. When I saw I become angry, I thought, oh, obviously, I'm in Maya. So sometimes you might notice it's Maya when you get angry. You might notice that you're in Maya when it's become lust, when you have to have it no matter what. You might notice that you're angry when you get attached. You're in Maya rather when you get attached. So at what stage you notice it depends on your advancement. Now, how can you speed up the process? There's many different answers for that. But I'll give you this answer is an answer in the context of your question. One way that we can speed up that process is that as soon as we notice it's Maya, whatever stage you notice it's Maya, immediately let go of it. As soon as you notice, at whatever point you notice, as soon as you notice, let go of it. And Krishna will be pleased with you, and he'll start revealing to you earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier in the process when it's Maya. Now, you'll notice that there's some things that you'll start to be able to notice at a very early stage, and other things to which you have greater attachment, and which we've been attached for many, many lifetimes, that it, we still haven't figured out that it's Maya, frankly. And if some of you are on a stage of bhava, this doesn't apply to you, but to any of you, there may be. There are many devotees in this movement who are very advanced, and not all of them are obvious. So don't laugh. There may be people here who are at the stage of bhava, and I've met some very advanced devotees in many interesting situations. So for those of you on the stage of bhava, this does not apply. But anyone who is below the stage of bhava, there are still some aspects of Maya that we do not recognize as Maya, and I will pretty much guarantee that some of those are masquerading as bhakti. Pretty much give you 100% guarantee, according to Shastra and according to experience, that some of our weeds we think are bhakti. And we're really, really convinced that it's bhakti. And we're taking that material attachment, and we have a big iron fence around it, and we have pit bulls guarding it, and guys with spears. And when you live with each other, as some of you do, you know what that other person's weeds are that are guarded, don't you? You figure that out after a while. I can't talk to this devotee about this thing, right? I talk to this devotee about this thing, woohoo! Okay! You won't mention that anymore. So I can usually figure out what other people's weeds are that look like bhakti to them, but I can't see my own at all. And don't bother asking people. Please, don't. It's a waste of time. Until you let go of the guard dogs, they're not going to tell you. And people come to me, please tell me what my biggest attachment is. No way am I going to do that. Forget it. I used to do that. I don't do it anymore. I said, just ask Krishna. And he does. So gradually we start recognizing that one thing that comes when you're chanting, this is a warning. So if any of you, don't want to get on this ride, you can get off now. But a warning, that one thing that will happen to you as you're chanting is that you will see that some of the things, and it's probably the things that you hold most near and dear and that you're most attached to and you like best about yourself and you think is one of your best qualities, those are probably your biggest attachments. Those are probably your biggest Maya. It's a little warning. And it's not pleasant to see that. It's decidedly unpleasant. Because we're all honest with ourselves to Sunday. Oh, I have this problem, that problem. But this thing, this I do really well. This is in this way, I've got this thing, I'm really devoted to my guru, or I'm really devoted to preaching, or I'm really this is something that I really like about myself. And at some point, Krishna will say, guess what this really is? And you'll see it, and you'll go, oh, my God. You'll see it for what it is. The Maya will be cleared. So then if you respond to that, and you let go. Not the activity, remember, the consciousness, right? Remember that? Not change the activity. Krishna shows you that the real reason you're doing something is envy, or the real reason, whatever. The real reason you're worshiping the deities to get donations, or the real reason you're going on book distribution is envy, or the real reason you're serving your guru is, whatever. And he shows you this. You don't stop serving your guru, you don't stop serving the deity, you don't stop going out on book distribution, but you let go of the attachment. And as you do that, Krishna will start showing you Maya earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier and earlier. Earlier, and at the point of bhava, you will always see the naked form of Maya, and you will never become, you'll never even go to the contemplation stage. But he's not going to show you early on unless you respond. This is all, it's also the interplay between mercy and endeavor. If he shows you, this is, hey, hello, remember the fall down sequence? This is where you are in it with this thing. You're in Maya. This is nasty. And if your response is, no, that's not true, get out of here, Krishna, leave me alone. or if your response is, oh, that means I'm so fallen. He's not. Do you want to talk to somebody who acts like that? No. So he's not interested in that either. Or if you go and, I can't deal with that. That's too big. Oh, my God. Or that, oh, nah, that's not really the problem. Or, well, if I dealt with that, then what would happen? This would happen. If I gave up that attachment, well, maybe I wouldn't eat anymore. Maybe I wouldn't take care of my family anymore. Maybe nobody would like me anymore. You know, I can't get rid of that thing. But if we respond and say, wow, Krishna, ouch, ew, sorry about that. Ooh. Okay. Take out the tumor. Could you give me some anesthesia? All right, here you go. All right, Krishna. Whoa, I got rid of this big lump. Oh, thank you. Then he'll start showing you stuff soon. And eventually we'll get out of that. And the more you want to see it, and the faster you respond, the faster the whole thing will go. Okay? And the more you fight it, the slower the whole thing will go. Is that okay? And we should stop now, or I'm going to be in trouble, and they'll never invite me back. Thank you very much. So tomorrow morning at Gaur Yoga, we're going to be going over chapters 13 through 18. Adi Hadi Bo. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.